Les conférences du Collège de France.
Bonjour et bienvenue à toutes et à tous pour cette quatrième et dernière conférence de la professeure Shimazu Naoko, qui va porter aujourd'hui donc sur... nous sommes maintenant au milieu du deuxième conflit mondial qui va porter sur la Greater Asia, Greater East Asia Conference convoquée au Japon en 1943. Donc je rappelle que la professeure Shimazu a commencé par la guerre russo-japonaise de 1904-1905, et donc nous traversons donc la première moitié du siècle dernier, du XXe siècle, et vous allez voir que malgré le caractère très historique du propos, ça réveille quand même des échos assez contemporains. Alors, avant de lui donner la parole, I'd like to welcome, a special guest from Singapore, as far as I understand, you're more than welcome because, as you might know, Professor Shimazu has been teaching in at Yale NUS Singapore, for some years, and we also have. Colleague from Singapore, Andrew Hui, well, Singapore is very much represented here today, and I also, sort of greet some colleagues from here, Collège de France, Jean-Noël Robert, specialist of Japanese Buddhism, Jean-Jacques Hublin, specialist of paleoanthropology, and William Marx, specialist of comparative literature. So, yeah. So, well, and also I have to perform a little ritual that we have at Collège de France for guest lecturers who. Are brave enough to give four lectures, over a whole month, and they have a right to keep a souvenir, from the Collège de France, which is...
Thank you, merci beaucoup. Oh, wow, thank you so much.
Yeah. Mm. So,
Okay, yes. Well, thank you very, very much, Professor Chang. And it's already the fourth and the final lecture, and I know that some of you have come to almost every one of them, and I'm very grateful, and I hope that the last lecture will not disappoint. And I've been really quite struck in terms of, I've been very impressed, actually. Not only is this an honorable and very privileged opportunity to give lectures at the Collège de France, but it has always also been a very humbling experience for me, basically to be reminded of the importance and joy of public intellectual engagement and why we are who we are. In a way, as intellectuals, academics. So I can't thank you enough, Professor Chong and the college, for all this and making this possible for me. Okay, so today's lecture is on symbolic diplomacy. And I'm going to be talking about General Tojo, who you might know from the Second World War, and the 1943 Greater East Asia Conference. And this conference is often known as the Tokyo Conference, so you might know it in that sense. But the story I'm going to tell today will be quite different from probably the stories that you might hear about conferences, generally speaking, because I'm interested in something slightly different from other historians, as you may have found out by now if you've been to my lectures before. So the plan for today is... I'll give a very quick intro to the Great East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere during World War II. And Then I talk about this General Tojo, who was the prime minister at the time of the conference, and his particular interest in Southeast Asia. And then I'll give a sort of like an introduction to the outline of the Tokyo Conference, or the Greater East Asia Conference, and then talk about Tojo's Greater East Asia diplomacy, because he had a particular conception of that diplomacy for Greater East Asia sphere. And then I'm going to talk about, as part of explaining Tojo's version, how to show equality of states. So how do you actually enact that in a diplomatic setting? And then also, Tojo wanted to be the most perfect host. So I'm going to talk about his role as a host of the conference. And then in that role, this is number 7, we talk about the informality of familial relations among the Greater East Asia leaders. And then the final stage of the Greater East Asia Declaration, the final stage of the conference, which led to this declaration. And then the staging and enacting Japan's vision of Asia as a sort of concluding remarks. Right, so very quickly. So Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere involved a rapid expansion of Japanese empire in what is known as the southern region. So previously, Japan actually had an East Asia new East Asian order that was declared in 1938. So this is sort of like the version that includes the Southeast Asia, as well as Japanese empire and the Manchukuo, and the Japanese-controlled regime in one part of China, which was called the Nanjing regime. So December 1941 for Japan and the rest of the world in the region was a very big turning point, because Japan, as you know, attacks Pearl Harbor, and that opens up the Pacific theater of the Second World War. And then at the same time, Japan planned an invasion into Southeast Asia. And so therefore, December is all about Japanese occupying Thailand, Malaya, Hong Kong, and Guam in Southeast Asia and the Pacific, apart from the Hawaii, which is happening, going on at the same time. Now, by January 1942, Borneo, which is which actually is part Malaysian and Indonesian, the Philippines, the Wake and Bismarck Islands in the Central Pacific had been occupied by the Japanese. And then, of course, for those of you from Singapore, February is a big day for the Japanese, the fall of Singapore. And then in March, this military expansion actually continues into Indonesia and Burma. So the expansion of the perimeter defense from the Kurile Islands, which I'm going to show you this terrible map, but at least you can see the whole kind of the Kurile Islands here, to the Marshall Islands in the Central Pacific, and of course to Timor, Java, Sumatra, Malaya, to Burma. So the Japanese kind of perimeter defense really expands very rapidly in about 100 days. Now, of course, this Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere had as its main jargon or main slogan, which was liberating Asia from the yoke of Western imperialism. The southward advance, as it's called, going into Southeast Asia, was initially basically to secure war material and natural resources to continue the war effort, because Japan was getting very stuck in China. So there had been a stalemate in China for a few years, and the war had to be somehow re-galvanized, and Japan at this time obviously was hoping to win. Now, there were different patterns of collaboration that happened in the Southeast Asian region. And first one is actually the joint rule with the former colonial regime, which was in the French Indochina. And then there was an allied relationship which had been signed through treaty with an independent state, and Thailand represented that sort of category of collaborationist regimes with Japan. And then thirdly, there was the direct military occupation by the Japanese forces in Burma, Philippines, Malaya, and the Dutch East Indies. Okay, so let us talk about this Tojo. So he was prime minister in general, and he was prime minister of Japan from October 1941 to July 1944. And he was obviously, those of you who know anything about the Second World War in Asia and Pacific, he was convicted by the international military tribunals for the Far East for war crimes, you know, and sentenced to death. Now, we are looking at Tojo in 1943, or going back slightly further, 1941, 42, 43. So he had a major interest in Southeast Asia, and he was the first head of the Japanese government ever to visit the region. And in 1942, he created this new ministry, government ministry, called the Greater East Asia Ministry, which had a mandate to cover this big coal prosperity sphere. And then he visited Manila in May 1943. And in early July 1943, he went to Bangkok, Singapore, and what used to be Dutch East Indies, but East Indies. And then he had a very keen interest in wanting to visit these places and meet the leaders and people, which was actually a rarity by contemporary Japanese political standards. So we're talking about the prime minister who was not your usual kind of Japanese prime ministers who were not interested in visiting any of these regions. He actually was. And so if you look at his diaries of day-to-day activities, Southeast Asia as a topic takes up quite a lot of his day-to-day dealings, various kinds of dealings going on as Prime Minister of wartime Japan. Now, obviously, frequent visits were also made to Tokyo by the leaders of these countries, particularly in 1943. Bao Mao, who was the Prime Minister of Burma, he visited Tojo in late March and again in mid-June. And Subhas Chandra Bose, who was the leader of Azad Hind, which was the Free India state, which was wanting to be independent and not yet. So Bose and Jose Laurel, the Filipino premier, visited Japan in mid-June. And from Thailand, two visits from Prince Wan Thiaphong, and Bao Mao visited Japan five times, basically, between 1941 to 45 during wartime. So that's quite a sort of, you know, investment going on in terms of establishing contacts. So this is, Tojo says in July 1943 to the cabinet, states of Greater East Asia are not foreign countries, but even towards weaker and small states, we must adopt the form of equal treatment. Greater East Asia Ministry also is constructed on the notion that they, i.e. these states, are not foreign states. And so he has a particular kind of notion of equality, and that's what I'm going to try to explain to you. Now, here you see this famous photo that you may have seen. So this is taken on the steps of the Imperial Diet Building in Tokyo during the conference of 1943, November. And we have here from the left, Bao Mao from Burma, Jiang Jinhui from Manchukuo, the head of Premier Manchukuo, Wang Jingwei, who was the head of the what was called the reorganized government of China, or the Nanjing regime. And then you have Tojo in the middle. And then to his right, you have Prince Wan Thiaphong from Thailand, and then Jose Laurel from the Philippines. And then you have Bose from Azad Hind. Now, you're going to see this again, but I'm just going to show you this for now so that you can see who was there. And so, The Greater East Asia Conference was held on the 5th and the 6th of November. And Tojo chaired the conference and convened it and planned it in really quite a detail. And it's quite significant that this conference is taking place on the 5th and the 6th, mainly because the 3rd of November was at the time known as the Emperor Meiji's birthday. So you might know this, but Japanese emperors' birth dates turn into national holidays. So this is Tojo wanted these leaders to come early enough so they could be part of this celebration of the Meiji Emperor's birthday on the 3rd of November. Today is known as the Culture Day, Bunka no Hi. Anyway, so you have here the conference gathered the five independent, so independent in quote-unquote, states of Manchukuo, the reorganized national government of China, i.e. the Nanjing regime, the Philippines, Burma, Thailand, and Wanjing, and I also gave you the names already. Now, amongst the invited states, Thailand was the only state which had not been occupied by Japan, although it was sort of forced to sign an alliance or treaty alliance with Japan in order for the Japanese not to invade Thailand, although they actually did invade from the southern part of Thailand in 1941, December. But anyway, so Prince Wan Thiakon, he was given the title of HRH, which is His Royal Highness, few days before coming to Tokyo, so that he would be treated properly by the Japanese. And the actual Prime Minister of Thailand was somebody called Phibun Songkram, and he refused to come to Japan. And so Prince Wan, who had been actually an official diplomat of Thailand for many years by this time, he was at the Paris Peace Conference of 1919. If you're here last week, we spoke about that. This is all so that Prince Wan would have the necessary gravitas to deal with Japan. Now, Korea and Taiwan were not invited because they were colonies of Japan, so they were not independent. Nor was Malaya and East Indies, or Indonesia nowadays, mainly because these two areas were under the direct military occupation of the Japanese armies. And they were considered to be too important to be given independence for the kind of strategic rationale that the Japanese had at the time. Now, so as I said, to this lineup of the independent states, the Japanese had carefully orchestrated the arrival of Subhas Chandra Bose, of this Azad Hind, and he arrived actually earlier than everybody else. He arrived on the 30th of October, but the Japanese said, oh, it's such a coincidence that Bose was visiting, so he can join the conference as an observer. And so this is what happened. So the thing about this conference is that everything is meticulously planned. So everything is planned to effect, and nothing is left to spontaneity, and that's the very important thing to realize. Now, why was this conference held? Largely for two reasons. First of all, to show a united front against the Allied powers, because Japan was one of the Axis powers in the Second World War, not on the side of the Allies as it was during the First World War. Now, secondly, to confirm the establishment of the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. And the conference is concluded with a declaration, which I will talk about a bit later on. Now, the timing of the conference is very important because when this actually takes place, when the military fortunes of the Japanese began to suffer some serious setbacks. So this is already in the phase when Japan is beginning to retreat during the Second World War. And for example, the Battle of Guadalcanal was a major, major setback. And there have been lots of setbacks like Midway and so on happening. So the propaganda value of this war was obviously this thing called the liberation of Asia. and independence of Asian peoples. And notably, this was the only large-scale diplomatic pageantry to be held in wartime Japan, centered on this Greater East Asia co-prosperity idea. So this conference has not been given enough scholarly attention over the years, although some research has come out recently, notably by Jeremy Allen, mainly because the event comes across as being Japan's ill-fated and grandiose charade without much substance or credibility to speak of. So my question to this kind of historiography was, but why did Tojo do it if it was so obviously a charade? Because I think everything has a reason. And so I kind of really got interested in trying to understand the reason why he did it regardless. So for Tojo in Japan, this conference was symbolically important, and it's best understood as a symbolic diplomatic performance. So what do we mean by symbolic? And how can we understand and explain the symbolic in diplomacy? Anyway, to uncover the underlying structure of symbolic meanings embedded in the conference, I focus on the organization of the conference. Meticulously planned, every detail was planned and scripted with a meaningful intent. And when something seems to be like a useless conference, often this is one way of understanding why they did it anyway. I tried my hand at doing diagrams, and this is the diagram that explains Tojo's Greater East Asia diplomacy. And so basically, he has two elements. And for him, these two elements are compatible. And for many people in the audience, it would seem incompatible. So on the left, you have the appearance of equality of states that exists between sovereign states, like the European Westphalian state system. States are equal because of sovereign status of the states. And if you remember back to the quote he gave to the cabinet, it is the form of equality that's important. Form, you know, rather than the actual equality. And on the right, you have the informality of familial relations among states within the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, like the Sino-centric family of nations idea. Yeah, so you kind of think, why? How could these things come together in his mind? So they were compatible and overlapping to him. And so what he tries to do is he tries to perform these two roles during the conference as the host. In staging the conference, and secondly, in his personal performance in the role as a host of the conference. Right, so how do you demonstrate this? In the Greater East Asia called Prosperity Sphere, nominally speaking, Japan is one of the states, yet it is the leading state. So it's this principle of primus inter pares. If you do international relations or politics, you probably have come across this word. So you got to think about ways of placing the invited states in the order, so that somehow Japan will come out first. Because if you do the Roman alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, Burma will come first, China will come first, everybody will come first before Japan, and this will not do. So the Japanese really thought out, how can we come first? And yet we say it's equal. So they thought, why don't we use the Japanese alphabet? And it's called Iroha. So there's a lot of creative thinking going on behind these things. And here, yeah, it's Iroha ni hoheto chiri nuru wo waga yodare zo tsune naran yui no yokoyama kyo koete asaki yume inji yoi mo sezu. So the yellow bits I highlighted are the kind of alphabet letters. So the first one, ni, is Japan, obviously. So you see it here. Let me. Yes, so this is ni, Nippon, Japan. Chi, Chugoku, Jongo, you know, China. Ta, Thailand. Ma was, what was ma? Chugoku.
Manchu.
Yes, thank you. Manchu. Manchuko, Manjo. And who is Philippine. Philippines. And he, or he is Burma, Biruma. Right, so so Tojo's personal, you remember the personal, you know, emphasis on the importance of the form and his preference to try to avoid treating any state better than others, because he worried that if he kind of put some state over the others, then they would be the more favored state within this greater East Asia sphere. So in this, the most important thing is actually that Nippon, or Nihon, Japan, played the role of an independent state within the Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere to demonstrate that Japan was actually one of them, but first among equals. And then you will see in the lining of the states, so you see, Tojo, ni, right? And I think chi, ta, ma, Manchukuo, Philippine, and Burma. Now, the Burmese premier complained that he became, or Burma became independent before the Philippines by a few months. So why was he placed last? And then he said, he was told, well, it's just too bad, it's the order of the alphabet. okay, and there are other examples I'm going to show you. This is the seating of the conference room in the Imperial Diet building. And number one is Tojo, and number three is China, Wang Jingwei. And this is one Thaiakon of Thailand. And so the order goes like that. Right? And then you've got each delegate sitting behind with the other delegates. And then the most interesting thing, I got to actually do more research on this because it's kind of bothering me in a nice way. Why are the bonsais so prominent? Maybe somebody in the audience knows, can tell me about this. But bonsais are very important in this setup. And I still don't really understand why. Anyway, and then we go, you will see this in person. You will see Tojo at the head, and China, Thailand, Manchukuo, Philippines, Burma, and Azad Hind at the bottom. And you see the black shadow behind Tojo, that's the bonsai in the room. And then this is the floor plan of the building. And you will see here also, it's all planned like this whole entire conference. So this is the courtyard, and this is the budget committee room where the conference took place. Now, these are the waiting rooms where these delegations waited until they were. So this is the first, China, Thailand, Manchukuo, Philippines, Burma, Azad Hind. And it says here that the Japanese delegation were given rooms in the basement underneath. I know you're getting sick and tired of these photos, but there's another one with a similar kind of order lining up. Okay, so this obviously was a very important way of showing equality, you see. And yet Japan, ta-da, comes up first. Now, sorry, I'm going to talk about the equality of states, or actually more like equality in terms of importance of these states, was shown through the imperial audience, which Tojo had spent a lot of time organizing. And they were invited as independent states to the imperial palace, and given the highest honor of a three-hour visit to the palace. And this is extremely long by the standards of palace visits. So on the 4th of November, there was a cavalcade of Buick, you know, Buick American automobiles, mainly because the Japanese did not have a big enough made in Japan car by this time. And it went through the streets of Tokyo amid the flag-waving pupils and onlookers and disappeared into one of the gates of the palace. Now, within the palace, leaders were individually presented to the emperor in the Phoenix Hall, in the order of the Japanese alphabet. And then the lunch was held in another room without the emperor, but with Prince Takamatsu, the Grand Chamberlain Kido, the Imperial Household Minister Matsudaira, Great East Asian Minister Aoki, Foreign Minister Shigemitsu, and Tojo himself with the leaders. And then there was tea in another room, in the peony room. And this all ended at 2.05 p.m. precisely. And this is what you read in newspapers. They'll give you precise, almost like they would love to give seconds when they've ended. But anyway, it was 2.05 p.m. Now, let's look a bit more in detail about Tojo as in his role as the perfect host. So Tojo was the most conscientious host, if there was ever one. And he was known in Japanese as Junbima, fiend of preparation. He was basically always concerned about organization preparation. And the guests had to be treated extremely well. No expense was spared at every stage of the conference. So he was deeply held conviction that the Japanese had to take particular care not to let the smaller states lose face. Now, this meant that he personally inspected absolutely everything to ensure that everything satisfied his very exacting standards. Now, there is a word in Japanese called kikubari, and this is considered to be a virtue, you know, in Japanese. And so this attentiveness, kikubari, was a critical component of Tojo's performance. He kind of had to show this through action, and it enabled him to serve this dual purpose of the equal treatment of the states and the familial treatment of these countries. And also, if you think about it, it guarantees his position as the protagonist of the show. Now, one of the ways in which he tried to show his concern was the accommodation for our guests. He said the Imperial Hotel was not grand enough for the Greater East Asia leaders. So they were put up in various private residences in the western part of Tokyo. For instance, Wang Jingwei stayed at the Iwasaki Koyata's residence in Takanawa, and Prince Wan Taiyakon at Count Maeda Toshikatsu's residence in Komaba, and so on. So this arrangement, as you may be able to imagine, created quite a lot of additional work for the organizing committee, because these houses had been vacated at the beginning of the war. So they had been basically left unused for at least nearly 2 years. So they had to furnish and decorate these residences and so on. And then a few days before the conference, Tojo personally went and inspected each one of them with the general manager of the Imperial Hotel in tow. And the particular care and attention was given to heating and lighting. he instructed to brighten the lightning in Subhas Chandra Bose's residence after he noted that the dim sitting light was not appropriate. And then he said even the emperor had instructed Tojo to ensure that these visitors from the tropical climate regions would be kept warm and comfortable in the chill of Tokyo's autumn. Now, he made individual inquiries about accommodation and heating when these guests arrived. And he would say something like, "A few days ago, I made an inspection of your accommodation. But if there's anything that's wanting, please do not hesitate to let me know." Or something like, "It is so cold in Japan, so please take care, good care of your health, and do not catch cold." It's like your mother speaking to you, So evidently for Tojo, this show of what may seem like an excessive amount of personal attentiveness for the health and well-being of the delegates was a way of demonstrating his brotherly love to them. Maybe more like a parental love. At the same time, he also indicated that they were given the very best treatment by the Japanese host as equal partners, at least metaphorically speaking. So certainly Tojo had considered this demonstration of personal attentiveness as symbolically important in conveying this sense of right, equality, and the familial relationship. But it may be worth considering that this level of attentiveness may be sort of Asian in cultural practice and expectation of hospitality. And I say this is something that I kind of thought about quite recently, because when I was living in UK, when I read these documents long time ago, I thought Tojo was almost creepy in the way he kind of kept on asking about well-being and all this. But now that I live in Japan, I know it's normal now. So that's why I thought, I don't know, maybe it's a Japanese thing, or maybe it's an Asian thing, you know. Yeah. And then the next thing is about diplomatic gifts. So Tojo paid special attention to the selection of gifts, which had to be the very best Japan could offer. So normally dignitaries like state leaders visit, they give imperial decorations like medals and things like this. But they decided not to give out any medals on this occasion. So Tojo made extra effort to acquire special dispensation from the Imperial Household Agency to bestow imperial ducks from the imperial hunting grounds as special gifts from the emperor. So these people had to bring back imperial ducks to wherever they came from. And then general gifts were made of the Nihonga style, or Japanese kind of painting style, watercolors by the foremost painters of the day, such as Yokoyama Taikan, who is still a very famous Nihonga painter who died obviously a long time ago, but Wang Jingwei, who was the head of the reorganized national government of China, got Yokoyama Taikan's painting, and everybody else was given really quite significant paintings from famous painters. And then, you know, the photograph I showed you of the conference room, well, in front of each delegate, there was a purple cut glass ashtray, specially ordered, a lacquerware cigarette case, specially ordered, you know, a beautifully woven, which Kyoto style Nishijin ori, miniature national flag of the delegate's country, encased in glass commissioned for the occasion. So these guests were all chosen by Tojo. Now, at the Imperial Palace luncheon, remember, when they first arrived, they served very fine wine. And so Subhash Chandra Bose commented on how fine the wine was. And not only, and then he was told that they only served this on very special occasions because it was a gift from Napoleon III to the last shogun, Tokugawa Keiki. And Bose was obviously very surprised to hear this. Everybody else was, and this was noted in the media. So anyway, Tojo had this dictum, which is don't be miserly. So this means kechikechi suru na in Japanese, on gifts and souvenirs. As the head of the Greater East Asia family, Japan must act generously and magnanimously to all its gifts, guests. Utmost importance to facilitate relationship building with these Asian leaders, but also on a larger level as a reflection of the relationship between Japan and the other states within the co-prosperity sphere. So you can see that the form, right, is extremely important to Tojo, and form in Japanese culture is also very important. If you know Kabuki, it's all about the form, i.e. the role that you have in each of the social contexts that you may be in. Now, this informality of familial relations. So Tojo preferred to think or preferred way of explaining disagreements between Japan and the Great East Asia countries as though they were like squabbles between husband and wife, fufu genka, or squabbles between older brother and younger brother, kyodai genka, or squabbles between older brother and, oya no kokoro ko shirazu, the child does not understand the feelings of the parent. You see? And so in every instance, what you notice is that the relationship was not one of equals, because the relationship between the husband and wife were not considered to be equal at the time. And it was a hierarchical relationship. So Tojo always played the stronger figure, the father figure, the older brother figure, the husband figure, or what have you. Now, so he would tell these visiting leaders, you must come and tell me if you got any problems, worries. So some of these leaders did go and tell and complain to Tojo. And one of them that I'm going to share is the Filipino Premier Laurel. He complained that the Japanese were sending 200 advisors, basically military advisors, to the Philippines. And it makes the Filipino government, i.e. the independent Filipino government, look like a puppet regime. And then Tojo says, oh, really, Japan could not afford to send so many military advisors, so there must be something wrong. You know, and he invites Laurel to visit Japan again when he is in his capacity as the president of the Republic of Philippines. So he's kind of playing this thing of trying to make these leaders feel better, and sort of it's this carrot and stick approach. But so Laurel, and then when he visits as the president of the republic, not the premier, you know, then his audience, he can have an audience, proper audience with the emperor, like, you know, on one-to-one. And then Laurel, just to make sure he got something he also wanted, was to have a special presidential aircraft for use. And Tojo said, yes, of course, you know, you can have that. Anyway, so there's quite a lot of these kind of things going on between the leaders and Tojo during the conference. There are records of the post-conference discussions with these leaders going on, and they reveal that Tojo considered these rare face-to-face meetings as being crucial occasions to show his, you know, how good a host he was. And very tellingly is the very last paragraph, which is the most telling paragraph, which is that Tojo repeatedly told his aides that it was important to let these leaders have a degree of freedom by not cramping their style too much, as long as Japan was able to cast a bigger net over them. You see? So that's the thing. So I actually just want to show you this photograph because this is again a staged photograph. You saw the very formal looking lineup, didn't you? And this is just before that lineup. Basically, they're sort of saying, oh, you know, no, please stand here, please stand here. And then essentially, Prince Wan, the Thailand representative, he tells Thailand is here. Probably not. This is the Thailand premier, and this is China. So Tojo, and so Prince Wan says, please, please, you must sit in, stand in the middle because you're the host. But he was briefed to say this before. And then Tojo says, oh, no, 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 I mustn't stand because I'm the host. He said, no, 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 please, this thing going on. And then he's saying, oh, well, yeah, well, yes, yes, okay. And then he stands in the middle. So anyway, this is why I want to show you this, because it's really quite. And then, sorry, this Prince Wan plays a very important role, actually, because he's the only kind of real independent state in the conference. And so he had been briefed before the beginning of the conference, you know, when they're sitting in that room, to basically stand up and nominate Tojo as the chairman of the conference, because Tojo couldn't, kind of, so there's all this thing going on that Tojo could not say, okay, I'm the host, I'm the chairman of this conference. No, 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 you know. Prince Wan had to do this job, and so he does it very well, as you can imagine. So the final stage of the conference is the declaration of the Greater East Asia Declaration that takes place on the 6th, which is the second day of the conference. So how the conference ended sort of enables us to see the highly choreographed performance given especially by some of the leaders present. So at 10 o'clock, you know, they have a discussion of the joint declaration, which had been prepared by the Japanese beforehand. And they were to agree on the final draft of the joint declaration. And at the point of declaring, instead of like voting, right, you put your hand up to vote, what the Japanese asked the delegates to do was to stand up to show their agreement. So, you know, you'd be like standing up like this. Yes, I agree to this declaration. And then this declaration gets adopted at 12:55 p.m. Now, at this point, Ba Mao, who I'm going to show you this one because this is what's happening, Ba Mao, who is the Burmese prime minister, so he's actually standing here. He stands up and says that he would like to make a special plea to support the full independence of India, Azad Hind. To which Tojo promised to bequeath the Andaman and Nicobar Islands to Azad Hind in the near future. And then one of the major Japanese newspapers reported that Bose, Subhas Chandra Bose, here at this, at the end here, this person here, was in tears with gratitude. Now, then Tojo ceremoniously walks around the conference room and shakes the hands of individual leaders, as you can see. And this concludes the conference at 3:17 p.m. I still don't really understand why it took so long to get to this point from 12:55 p.m. to 3:07 p.m. But maybe I have to, yeah, there must be something happening that I have to find out. Okay, so for Tojo, the success of this conference was critical for underwriting his vision of the co-prosperity sphere, which included the controversial establishment of the Greater East Asia Ministry, because there was already foreign ministry, right? But foreign ministry was going to be doing what Tojo called pure diplomacy. So diplomacy with states which are really independent. and Greater East Asia Ministry was going to deal with the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. Now, so in that sense, you can say that the conference was, in some sense, make or break of Tojo's Greater East Asia project, at least in, you know, in the symbolic sense. And this is part of a big reason why he went to a considerable length to ensure its success. Right, so to conclude, I'm trying to conclude a bit sooner today. So staging and enacting Japan's vision of Asia. So one way of thinking about this conference is actually to think about the form and the shape it took place, mainly because, as we found out, form was really important to the success of the conference as far as Tojo was concerned, right? So if you think like that, then you can say that the conference represented the most up-to-date formation of what Asia looked like to the people of the time. And this is done through the collective bodily or physical presence of the leaders. This is why it was so important that they all came for Tojo. If one of them hadn't come, that it just wouldn't have worked, you see. And so the problem with Thailand, that Pi Bun Song Kram didn't want to come. And you know, they really had to work hard on having somebody come, and Prince Van actually came. So now you could actually have all the states there in presence. And so this was a visualization of an alternative and a definitive form to what Asia represented at this key historical juncture. And of course, this kind of falters, falls through very quickly. And then in Stockholm, Stockholm's newspaper reported, for example, that I read here, Japan was arranging a big demonstration of Greater East Asia under Japanese leadership that would be unbreakable federation for states in years to come. Well, so much for that. It totally broke down in less than a year. So the conference was, this is why I kind of want to emphasize the conference as a symbolic enactment. And it's the staging of the idea of what Greater East Asia looked like as a three-dimensional political reality by having those leaders there and lining up. And it, that sort of vision of the of that collective, which was extremely, extremely important. So at the most basic level then, the significance of the Greater East Asia Conference, or the 1943 Tokyo Conference, lies in the very fact of it having taken place. Thank you very much for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.